Hello everyone, before I start, if you'll forgive me, I have a podcast recommendation for you all. It's called the British Food History Podcast. I recommend it to you on the rigorous selection process that I really like it, and maybe you will too. Also, it's a great and rich subject. Most of all, though, I really like the host, who is Dr. Neil Buttery, and he really knows what he's talking about. He's an author, a PhD in the subject, he's got a really good blog as well, actually. But the main thing is he's an absolute and total enthusiast, and that to me is the heart of independent podcasting. He's doing it because he loves his subject, primarily. He's a warm and lovely host, he has lots of really great guests. So Diane Purkis of The People's History of the Civil War fame, she was there for example. She's now done The People's History Approach to Food. There's one just out on medieval food and one I absolutely loved on school meals. How I laughed at that one and cried just a little bit at the memory of the tubes in school liver. So much yuck. Anyway, it's great. Give it a go on your normal podcatcher, the British Food History Podcast with Dr. Neil Buttery.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History of Anglo-Saxon England, Series 2, Episode 2.5, Life on the Inland. Last time we heard about the large, multiple estates of the Shires, a world of independent free peasants and extensive lordship, where the yoke of hierarchy and lordship lay relatively lightly on the shoulders of the English churlish family. Today we're going to talk about how that life began slowly to change for some, depending on who your lord exactly was. We're going to talk about a process we might call intensification. Intensification of the exploitation of land, intensification of lordship. Central to the topic is where you lived, the landscape you worked. And there are two central concepts about which you're going to hear a lot. So, on the principle that good education practice is endless repetition, or gum-bleeding history, as we call it here, let me introduce you to those words early. And then I'll repeat them and repeat them until you tell me that your gums are bleeding and I can stop. The first of those words is warland, which is a deceptively exciting-sounding word, conjuring up images of mighty warriors striding the world like Xena, like equally mighty Colossi, if that be the plural of Colossus. Actually, although it is very exciting, it is not about that. It is actually related to the old English word waru, or defence. And the word therefore means territory intended to help defend the country or the land of the people. But we're not going to talk about Warland today, so you can forget all about that. That treat will be for another day. Instead, we are going to talk about intensification. We are going to talk about the other word, which is inland. Inland means that innermost land of the multiple estates we heard about last time. The land closest to the centre, to the tribute centres, or the home of the reeve or the lord, whoever the lord might be. We're going to talk about how the demands on that kind of land changes from the 9th century onward. How some lords began to demand more of it, expect greater output, and why they do that, and how the lives of their peasantry are therefore affected and changed. Let me briefly give you the answer, which seems all wrong. Really, there should be some kind of great reveal at the end, but never mind. History's not supposed to be fun. Two things come together, really, in what happens. Residency and technology. First of all, some people start living in one place rather than moving around all the time, as has previously been the case. A lord and their household that stays in one place puts much greater pressure on the land that supports them. It makes it have to produce more and more continuously and reliable. It demands more, therefore, of their workforce and the land. So that's one thing, residency. The other thing is technology. There are improvements in technology which allow a more intensive agriculture. Okay, so that's the answer. You can forget the rest of the episode. Residency then. The tribute centres like Rendlesham begin to disappear because the lords that own them spend less time wandering around. I mean, they absolutely do still go from estate to estate, but they develop head offices where they are often resident with permanent staff that live there all the time. But that's not really the big prime mover in what happens. The first prime mover in what happens here are not this secular lot. They are, in fact, the church. Now, this will not be a podcast on the conversion. All I will say is that from the arrival of Queen and later Saint Bertha of Kent in 580, by 700 Christianity was the official religion throughout England, and by the mid-8th century paganism was being actively repressed. That's it. That's all for here about the conversion, despite the fact that it is, of course, a very rich history, and that St. Fraidswide, the patron saint of Oxford, comes from our hood in South Oxfordshire, and that religion is as important a part of daily life as ploughing the fields is. Despite that, not going to talk about it here. Not going to talk about it at all. There is a limit to how much I can cover in one series. What I am going to talk about, though, is residency again. Minsters, churches, and monasteries. Now look, we are used these days to a network of parishes, each with their church, in pretty much every village. But in virgin territory of the early days, that is not the way it started out. The early church had relatively few priests and vast territories to convert and then look after. So, the Anglo-Saxons dealt with this by establishing minsters. Minsters were large churches which had a community of secular clergy attached, otherwise known as priests. Each minster would manage a vast territory called a parochia. So off they'd go, these priests, periodically, each priest taking the word to the people. In the remote places in the hills of the Chilterns, for example, it would be a rare occasion indeed that you would see one. And it would be quede an event. Here's a quote from Bede which gives you a flavour. Wherever a cleric or a monk came, he was joyfully received by all as God's servant. The inhabitants crowded together, eager to hear from him the word of life. For the priests and the clerics came to settlements for no other reason than preaching, baptizing, visiting the sick, and in short, to care for their souls. So in our area of South Oxfordshire then, three main settlements of minster priests are established. At Dorchester before 800, and at a place called Purton before 1000. Purton was a village near Watlington at the foot of the Chiltern Scarp, and B, where John Hampden will get married. Wait until the 17th century for that story, Hampden the Great Patriot. The third minster was at Tame, where we have only evidence of its existence from about 1100. The thing about these communities is that although the priests will travel, At any one time, there is still a large community of people living in the same place demanding food and creature comforts all the year round. There is another process which overlaps chronologically but will take over and become the process: the building of local churches and the creation of parishes. Now, while we know this starts in Anglo-Saxon times and is well advanced, it is not complete until after the Normans arrive. In our area, it seems highly likely that the church established in the Royal Vill and Tribute Centre of Benson, the Church of St Helens, will take responsibility for the pastoral care of all the tuneships and hide farms scattered over the Shire all the way to the Thames on the eastern side. Churches are maybe established, or chapels, around about the Shire, and maybe even the odd resident priest. So we have minsters, estate churches, and the third type of religious settlement is the monastery, filled with regular clergies, monks whose job is to pray to the Lord continuously. As elites become richer, they begin to allocate land to found monasteries to save their souls and also to be a good citizen. In our area, there is an abbey founded at Dorchester by 635, one at Abingdon by 695, and a priory at Cholsey by 986. And then more stuff after 1066. This is a process which is going on all over England. Now, there are other reasons, by the way, for establishing a monastery other than, you know, just being good or saving your soul. One of these is about security of land ownership. Land is held by custom broadly in the earliest days. Falkland is the term. Obviously, the great war leaders and kings hold the largest chunks. Now, when land was given away by king or lord to someone or something, it was given by charter and then therefore has a new, more strictly defined status. Bookland, it will be called, because its ownership is written down, because priests can read, and they can read and write, the clever devils. We'll come back to that, but even though land's formally been given away to a monastery or nunnery, the patron retains a lot of control, a lot. So one theory, just to digress, is that many nunneries were established to make sure of a family's women's folks' future security, a place they could go to if unmarried or retire to later in life if widowed or for education in their youth. That's just as a by-the-by. But by the way, as they gave land away, the priests concerned would also very helpfully write up charters about the other land they held. So, the larger kings and war leaders get to hold land by book. Anyway, the churches and minsters were maintained by a new levy or tithe, I suppose, which was originally voluntary, called the Kirkesgeote. The word appears to be derived from the Old English short, or a division of land, but the payment becomes known as the church scot. It is, of course, the source of that famous phrase, scot-free, as in, I got out of not doing my homework scot-free, or whatever the specific application. The phrase definitively has nothing to do with the absence or presence of any particular location or situation of a native of Scotland. The church used the fine to maintain its fabric, which was its responsibility, while the parishioner's job was to maintain the church yard. Even as more local churches became established, a process we'll talk about in a minute, the minster remained in the background, monitoring, managing the priest and priests, organising the visitation of the bishop, which of course was never as frequent as the likes of the venomous Bede would have liked. Payment of said scot was required by all churls at Michaelmas, which was the 11th of November, and was another occasion for people to get together and hooly. It is a notable feature, I'm on another digression here, I suppose, really. It is a notable feature of the time that getting people together was a bit of a bother. You couldn't just hop in the wheels. You might be coming down from the hills with half a day's walk or more. So if there was a reason why you had to get somewhere and go get together, then you'd get together for many things at the same time, so you didn't have to do all that walking all the time. So it might be that the local court would be held on that day when the church scot was due. Or there's a tradition that land rents are paid at Martinmas or on Lady Day, which I think is the 25th of March. And these are other occasions for festivals. In such small communities, All of these days were opportunities to get together, and there was much rejoicing, and there was much ale, and hooly was had by all, and indeed by sundry. So anyway, the feature of minsters and churches and monasteries, which play a part in our story, is that they are all filled with a substantial number of people who, just to present my diploma as Professor of the Bleed Novice, all need feeding. Monasteries and minsters were endowed with plenty of land, by and large, so resources were not the problem. But the point is, they were resident, so they needed a reliable and continuous supply of nosh and materials and things. This was a very different situation to those royal estates and shires we have spoken about, where every year you brought your render to the royal tribute centre and then off you hopped. And at some point the king or dignitary would sweep by to consume said tribute and then disappear in a cloud of dust not to return for ages. But these guys are here all the blessed time. They're never going away. So something needed to be done to feed them. So areas of land would need to be specifically set up and managed to produce the basics all the time. Also, it would now need to produce more than it had formerly produced, because these priests and monks and nuns were basically not producing anything for themselves, sitting around praying and all that stuff, not ploughing and manuring. Well, not manuring in the right places, if you see what I mean. So it would be need to be farmed more intensively, and the farmers concerned would have to pull out their collective fingers and bend their collective backs to the wheel. So monasteries began to organise estates to maintain them in the state to which they really wanted to become accustomed. Let us call this new area inland, shall we? Okay, that's what we'll do then. The area of estate designed to feed the resident community shall now be known as inland, and inland shall be the name of the calling. Often this area was organised as part of a deal with the person making the original endowment to the minster, whether that was a noble or a royal patron. Now, all land normally carried obligations to pay a public tax, notably a tax called the geld. You will probably have heard of the geld. A version of it formed our pitiful attempts to make the Vikings go and leave us alone, the Dane geld. Well, you can often spot inland estates because one of the benefits given when setting up the deal was to remove the obligation to pay the public geld. Now, the object of our series is supposed to be the ordinary folks, and being a peasant, working on land for lovely religious people, and land not subject to at least one of the types of tax, the geld, sounds great, doesn't it? Well, as it turns out, is that it's anything but. For reasons along the lines of Spider-Man's dictum, with great power comes great responsibility. Hold that thought at some point over the next 3 or 4 decades. I promise I'll make it relevant. So a reason why these inland estates would be geld-free was, of course, because they faced an uphill challenge providing all this extra nosh for all the priests. The land would now have to support many more mouths all the time. So what we're talking about here is a pressure towards intensification. Intensification of production, fine, we're going to have to produce more, we need more, give us more. But intensification of production inevitably led to the intensification of lordship as well. How so, you ask? Well, because these priests were resident, they were there all the time to push their tenants, to manage them closely, to make sure they worked hard for them. Put out of your mind the idea that church landlords would just sigh, shrug their shoulders, piously proclaim that the Lord will provide, and eat fewer beans in their pottage. Nope. They wanted action. A high proportion of inland would therefore very often be held in domain, i.e. managed directly by the religious institution, often using the reeves and their families, and worked by household workers or by slaves. Often you can spot some of these early inland farms because they were often called bartons. The word barton derives from the most popular crop of the time, barley. So it's bira, bira tún, or barley farm. So if you see a place with barton as part of it, that's often a hangover from an inland farm worked by a monastery's household. Barton upon Humber, for example, in Lincolnshire. In our area, the village of Berwick was probably also Benson inland, because Berwick is derived from Berwick, barley farm. So how to produce more? how to increase productivity. One way might be about improving agricultural methods. And as it happens, there is a bit of this about around the 8th century. The first of these was the mouldboard plough. And since the use of the mouldboard plough is a remarkably influential sort of thing, I know it gets mentioned all the time. But really, you'd be surprised if I didn't cover it. I know you've probably heard all this before. It's the sort of thing that gets mentioned by sharp-looking authors in jeans, jackets, and a fitted headset, microphone and PowerPoint slides describing the history of the world in 35 minutes. But how could I do an English social history without mentioning it? The mouldboard plough was heavier. It could therefore work claggier clay soils. So that meant there was much more land that was open to cultivation rather than pasture, for example, or woodland. It's suggested sometimes that this is marginal, less fertile land that gets opened up, but that's not necessarily the case. So in our own area, South Oxfordshire, much of the land in the vale was of the heavier clay type, perfectly fertile, but just really hard to work and impossible to work with the ard plough, otherwise known as a stick. So, excellent, good news, more land. Also, the mouldboard plough was much quicker. This is because it turned over soil, so effectively you only needed to plough in one direction rather than crisscross like the old ard plough, and so one person could do more in the same time. So that's good then. It's nowhere near as hard. However, the new plough is something of a beast. It is big, it is heavy, so its ploughing is quite hard. Promise that is the last of the plough-related puns you will ever hear. Because it was so big, it meant that rather than two oxen pulling it, you needed a much larger team, maybe four oxen, and maybe even a team of eight. A team of eight, two abreast, with a plough behind it, is a very long thing, and the shape of fields, therefore, needed to be different. The longer the better, so you didn't have to turn so much. Think of an oil tanker trying to do a triple sulco with pike. And so I managed to link early English agriculture with Torval and Dean. Well done me. But also, a team of oxen is an expensive thing, both to buy and to maintain. They needed feeding as well, those oxen. And so the demand for pasture in the vale increased. So estates remodelled themselves extensively to make sure there was sufficient pasture for the oxen nearby rather than only far-off pasture to which the oxen would have to be walked and walked back. So there are landscape implications here. More of the lowland is now ploughed. We can see this in our area where arable has extended to the heavier clay villages like the Hazleys. There is greater demand for upland resources, therefore, of woodland and pasture, since more of the land in the vale is now being ploughed for arable and not available for pasture and so on. There are social impacts of this. Firstly, very few peasant farmers could afford the capital investment in plough and plough teams. So this favours the rich landlord, who could impose harsher terms on their farmers because they were the only ones that could provide them with the plough they needed. Also, there is a benefit in farmers sharing resources. So shared areas of pasture are developed. Common rights to land become much more important and much more prevalent. Another important area of innovation was the kind of crops grown. The most popular crop in the early Anglo-Saxon farm was barley, far and away, but now wheat made its reappearance as the crop of choice. Wheat re-entered the ring because although it's harder to work, it offered a greater number of calories per acre. Barley doesn't now go away, but it's no longer called King Barley, just barley. There's another factor which put greater pressure on inland farms. This is an era of gently growing population, a very long trend which carries on to the 14th century. Obviously, there is a long way to go before the excesses that exacerbated the Great Famine of 1315 and the Black Death in 1348 and so on. But over time, there are more and more people now competing for land, and so landowners can make harder demands on people. All of these pressures lead inexorably to a change in status for peasants working inland farms. The basic premise is this. that religious institutions are granted land, their estates needed tenants and farmers who could produce more, and the resident priests could manage them much more closely because they're around all the time. Plus, the institutions are the only one with the money to buy the right kit. The institutions wanted to make their terms and conditions much more demanding, and since existing extensive lordship imposed relatively light demands, there was surely scope to do so. But there is a problem. The rights of the churl were protected by law, but particularly by custom. The monastery might furiously demand more, but the churl could simply turn them away, refuse, refer to custom, call in their colleagues to confirm, no, 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 this is the way it's always been done here. That moral economy we shall talk about loads and loads. But the thing is, against that, medieval life was precarious, as we have often said. Maybe a smaller peasant landowner has split up their holdings between their children far too much over the generations, and therefore they're on the breadline in bad years, given the amount of land they've got. The idea of primogeniture is very much a thing of the future, although landowners at all levels do try to keep their estates together. There might be a run of a few years of poor harvests, a few bad planting decisions, a roving warband over your land, and suddenly you could be on your uppers, desperately looking for a helping hand. And that might mean going cap in hand to your lord and asking for a few concessions, a bit of credit, a rent holiday, less tribute, for example, or simply a bit of a handout to tide them over. Now, there's a basic, often repeated understanding that there was a sort of contract between peasant and their lord, this thing called the moral economy, a sense of reciprocal obligation, the right way to do things that preserve the dignity of both. But it could be a little more brutal than that when there was trouble. The practical arrangement between peasant and lord was very often the least bad deal that the peasant could get away with. It goes then that the peasant family that has fallen on hard times has had a conversation with the lord. Look, Gov, we're in a spot of bother. Nothing we can't handle, just a temporary problem. OK, says the boss, we'll help you out. But in returns, things are going to have to change around here just a bit. It might be a conversation like, look, you're going to have to give me the land you hold. Don't worry, you'll get some of it back, but you'll be working it in return for some labour dues. Or look, you can hang on to all your land, but you'll hold it from me and have to work on my domain 3 days a week. Oh, and I'm going to be telling you when you're going to do and what you're going to do when you arrive for your labour days. You don't get to choose. You're no longer independent. Or it could be the introduction of a cash rent. The possibilities of exploitation are endless. By a variety of pressures, the status of the families that worked in land estates changed, from free peasant with a direct relationship with the king to a smallholder or even cottager owing service to a lord. So this leads me to a basic fault line you might like to be aware of, a fundamental division in society, and this concerns the concept of service. Service was not a dirty word in medieval England of any period. The association of service with lowly status comes much later in English history. There was pretty much nobody in medieval society anyway that did not serve somebody. The very greatest of thanes owed service to the king. But the type of service, that did make a difference. There was honourable service and the kind of service that conferred no honour at all. On one side of the line, the honourable side, were things like carrying messages for the lord, hunting, guarding the lord's possessions or estates. On the other side of the line are things like muck spreading or liming, which was the digging out of lime to spread on the fields to improve their fertility, which is hot, hard, physical, dirty work. This work is not exactly dishonourable, that conveys the wrong meaning, but neither does it confer status and honour. It is work to be avoided if at all possible. The type of service you provided, therefore, gave you a clue as to the status of the person. Another aspect about service was its predictability or otherwise. So let's say that you owe your lord a day's work during harvest time. That's thoroughly predictable, and you can probably pitch it proudly as having nothing to do with service so much as simply one family helping out another. This kind of work is called boon work. It's given as a favour to the wider community. Every year, everyone gets together to help bring in the harvest. It is part of the reciprocal rites of custom freely given. On the other hand, if you have to turn up at the boss's for 3 days a week, come rain or shine, and if you then get doled out work and have to do whatever jobs are hanging about, then your fish are in a very different type of kettle indeed. It is a much lower status kettle altogether. As time goes by, the changes in the terms of service on inland estates creates a series of recognisable ranks among this kind of peasantry with tied service, which we'll go through, but there are common threads in it. One is the loss of rights of inheritance. So churls had the right to pass on their land. The new inland workers did not. They were basically given a set and a kit by the lord. Implements, land, house. When they died, it all went back to the lord. Now, the practicalities of life meant that the next generation of the family would be the first in line and probably get it built back, but it wasn't a gimme. Another fault line is this type of service thing. They owned very defined work, and that work was based on a private contract with a lord. The land they held was a result of a contract, and that is very new, because churls generally held land because it was theirs. They held it from custom. They had customary rights. And Anglo-Saxon law reflected this because it had very little to say about property. Anglo-Saxon law is all about personal relationships. It is very typical of the Anglo-Saxon state that the laws of Ina, for example, are all about civil injury, crimes against people, not criminal law, which is crime against the state. So, let us turn to the kind of inland workers recognised as part of an estate, described in a 10th century document of enormous value and interest, the Rectitudines Singularum Personarum, which described a model estate and its people and what they did. Okay, so the status of our first category was much more common on inland, but is known throughout Anglo-Saxon society. I speak of the slave, the Theowas or Wealas. Here in the 10th century was a conversation recorded with a ploughman from the Oxfordshire village of Eynsham about his day, an exceptionally rare record of the voice of the powerless. It comes from a homily via the abbot of Eynsham, and we think this ploughman was probably a slave, though it's not certain. He is at very least unfree. "Oh, I work very hard, dear lord. I go out at daybreak, driving the oxen to the field, and yoke them to the plough. For the fear of my lord, there is no winter so hard that I dare skive off at home. But the oxen having been yoked up, and the share and coulter fastened to the plough, I must plough a full acre or more every day. Have you any companion?" "Yes, I have my lad driving the oxen with a goad, who is hoarse now because of the cold and the shouting." "What else do you do in a day's work?" "I do more than that, sire. I have to fill the oxen's bins with hay and water them, and carry their muck outside."
My, it sounds like hard work then."
"It's hard work, all right, sir, because I'm not free."
To be a slave did not necessarily mean that you're one of the old Britons, as was once thought on the basis of Gildas's diatribe, nor did it necessarily mean you'd been captured in some war or other. Of course, it might mean either of those things. But as we can see from the history of the Gewissa, which had some British origins, many people of British descent were simply part of the Anglo-Saxon nation and with perfectly high status. Many slaves also fell into slavery through circumstance, by falling on hard times and being forced to sell their freedom to their lord in return for survival. There was a halfway house. It was permissible to sell your children into slavery if they were under the age of 7 and with their consent under the age of 14. That sounds pretty desperate, of course, and indeed it was. It must have been a desperate calculation that for your children the life of a slave was better than they could expect as a freeman. But if there was no or little chance of them surviving, well, that was their last chance. Here is a quote for you which sheds a bit of light on it. It is a statement in the will of a noblewoman called Jeat Fleda. "Jeat Fleda has given freedom for the love of God and for the need of her soul. namely to Echeard the smith, and Elfstan and his wife, and all their offspring, born and unborn, and Urchil and Cole, and Ecfert and Eolhun's daughter, and all those people whose heads she took for food in the evil days. There it is then, all those people whose heads she took for food in the evil days. Here are people who went to their lady, Giatfleda, when they had reached their wits' end about how to feed themselves. They were in a situation so dire they could not even really negotiate serfdom. They had to give themselves completely into servitude in order to survive. The Gorbet also specifies the children, so children born to a slave were themselves automatically born slaves. The model of slavery probably followed Roman law. They were the chattels of their master, without any legal personality and without kin. It is not clear just how important slaves were in the economy of the time. Slaves numbered in the Domesday Book of the 11th century about 10% of the total population. But by that stage, numbers of slaves had probably been declining for a while, for reasons we'll come to. But on the other hand, it seems almost certain that many slaves were not declared in Domesday. So the answer is probably that they played an important part in the rural economy, and they played that part in estates both large and small, and that they were probably more than 10% of the population in the 8th and 9th centuries. The church was a large-scale landowner, and canon law did not condemn slavery outright, and therefore the church was indeed a large-scale owner of slaves. On that line, it is faintly ironic that the Archbishop of York, Wulfstan, gave a famous sermon in the early 11th century excoriating those English who sold their fellow English into slavery. At the same time, he probably had well over 400 slaves on his estates. Do as I say, not as I do, seems to be the immortal subtext. The church did tell its bishops that they should free their slaves on their death, and gave this message also to their parishioners, as we have seen Giatfleda do. Slaves might also ask neighbouring landowners to intercede on their behalf, and could also buy their own freedom. The corollary of that last one is that, of course, it meant that slaves could own money, but it seems that they did so at their own risk, because they had no legal rights if somebody took it from them. However that went for them, they could not anyway pass anything they had accumulated onto their children. Everything they held was the property of their master. If a slave did earn their freedom, they were traditionally taken to a crossroads where a ceremony was carried out. The crossroads might symbolically represent the different choices and paths that the slave, now freeman, had. It also, of course, symbolised the right the slave now had, or the ex-slave now had, to travel. By and large, the little evidence there is suggests that landowners took the view that their interests were best served by working slaves full-time over a long period. This meant that it was worth looking after them. This meant it was worth investing time to train them in specialised skills. It also meant that slaves could be deployed to carry out the most crucial tasks and thereby reduce a landowner's overall risk. The slave, of course, couldn't leave, unlike a free ploughman, for example. So, if I refer back to that gobbet of Giatfleda, you'll see that the slave Echeard was a blacksmith, which is a highly skilled job. Other references we have show slaves as skilled stockmen, beekeepers, dairymaid, swineherd, and above all as ploughmen. The role of ploughman, one of the most skilled and most critical jobs in the rural economy of all, is consistently associated with slaves on inland estates. Women usually worked in the household. We have another record where another noblewoman, Athelgifu, freed her slaves, and they were seamstresses, skilled needlewomen, and weavers. And by the by, it's also worth noting that her priest was a slave. That is fascinating, and on occasion happens elsewhere as well. Slaves were very much inland workers, tied to the household and estate. Not just for large landowners like the church either. In fact, Smaller landowners probably relied even more on slaves because they had fewer tied tenants to help them with their work, and with smaller estates, the ability for slaves to carry out higher status, specialised roles was probably lower. They were much more likely to be the jack of all trades, master of none. Slaves probably lived in shared slave huts, possibly the sunken buildings found on many sites, and they have also been given a small plot of land on occasion. These small plots were designed to help them feed themselves, but categorically not to allow them to become self-sufficient. In a larger estate, they might also get some perks, like traditional handouts at harvest time. The records of one estate required slaves to be given food at Easter and Christmas and a harvest handful, a point at which you'd presumably look around for any friends with unusually large hands to help out. The general story, though, as I have mentioned, will be of a move away from slavery, a movement that the conquest of 1066 will accelerate. Recent research has shown that the process was actually slower and more prolonged than used to be thought, but nonetheless, that was the way it was going. Instead, slaves tended to be given small plots on the inland and therefore categorised as serfs rather than slaves. It was found that more was produced for the landowner that way. It's not a great improvement for the slave. Unlike many of the other peasant groups we'll come to, they depended entirely on their lord, therefore. The land they gained was essentially like a wage given in kind in land. And they shared much more in common, therefore, with wage labourers, the most dependent category of non-slave, rather than the poorest type of serf. On then to the most dependent of the unfree serf, the Bordars. Just to give you a point of reference, a reasonably well-off, self-sufficient peasant family would expect to hold a yardland or a vergate of land. This is equivalent to about 30 acres or a quarter of a hide. Now the Bordar would still hold a bit of land, but a lot less than that. They would be given a very small holding and a toft, a small cottage. They would then be tied to the inlander's estate. And in fact, their very name describes their role, which was often to work in the household as well as a general labourer outside. Although the Oxford English Dictionary quotes the name as taken from the Latin Bordarius, cottager, an alternative etymology is from the Old English and French, borde, or table, a word which also goes on to become board in terms of, you know, full board, room and food for the day, the sort of thing you see in a hotel or something like that. So, Bordars had come to be associated with work that supported the lord's personal household. Essentially, Bordars were general labourers, whom the lord has decided were easier to pay partly in land. So, the Bordar would hold lambs deemed just about sufficient to feed themselves, maybe around 5 acres or so, but this made them precariously subject to the winds of fate and climate, and they'd expect to get some food as part of their daily work. On the estate, their tofts were often grouped very close to the centre, referred to sometimes as the Bordlands. Bordars might work on the lord's estate or household, spreading muck, the substance euphemistically referred to as night soil, liming, building, cleaning chimneys, that sort of thing. For this small holding to maintain themselves, they would give a very heavy service to the lord, maybe 3 days a week, which would leave them frighteningly little time to work their own small holding. They would be too poor to maintain their own plough, so they would have to bargain for a share or use of another villager's plough. Essentially, this is a group of families who found themselves in this precarious position because they'd once had very little bargaining power and been forced to accept a contract heavily weighted in favour of the landowner. They might not strictly be a slave because they have legal status and rights, but I wonder if it felt very much different in practical terms. The question is, how many Bordars are there then? And our only real point of reference is, as always, Domesday Book in 1087. And by that time, Bordars would form around 30% of the population. We are, of course, still in the 8th century, and their numbers would have been very much lower then, since this private landowner thing is only just getting going there with ecclesiastical estates. The story that will unfold is that as lords, both secular and ecclesiastical, demand more and more of their tenants, more and more tenants of inland estates will fall on hard time and fall into the category of poorer serfs, bawdars and ubors, a far cry from the free, self-sufficient farmer and churl. Our last category of inland peasant then was called the ubor, and their name has survived in the word boar, a word which, of course, is not the most positive. But there again, there was no negative association with the word back there. Now the life of the ubor was better than the bawdar, but it was still a hard one. Though it is a little difficult to be definitive about how hard, because customs varied from place to place. And if there is one thing you might like to take away from all of this, is that although there are very much national trends going on, the reality from place to place depended very much on that local situation and landlord. Indeed, a 10th century estate document remarked that the ubor gave labour rent which was in some places heavy, in some places light. On this particular estate, which is at Bath, there is quite a description of the terms and conditions which a new peasant might expect if they moved to Bath Abbey. It was designed to attract new immigrants, in fact. I can even visualise the poster in my mind's eye. Not sure what to do with your life? Go west, young man, and become a ubor. A free year if you come to Bath Abbey. Because the incoming ubor was given a year off from their cash rent as an incentive to move there. After that, he needed to pony up his 10p a year. They were granted a yard land, which, as I have mentioned, is a quarter of a hide, or 30 acres. Of those 30 acres, he was provided with 7 sown acres, 2 oxen, 6 sheep and a cow. He was provided with tools for his work and utensils for his home. I am then going to quote a bit more of the T&Cs. I doubt you'll retain all of this, but just see what you think. He must work for 2 days in each week, doing such work as he is directed to throughout the year, and to work for 3 days each week during the harvest, and for 3 days each week from Candlemas to Easter. So that's like a couple of months or so. He must pay 10 pennies tax on Michaelmas Day, and on the day of St. Martin's Mass, he must give 23 sesters of barley and 2 hens. At Easter, he must give a young sheep or 2 pennies. And from Martin's Mass to Easter, he must remain with the Lord's fold as often as it comes round to him. And from the time when one first ploughs to Martinmas, he must plough 1 acre each week and collect the seed himself from the Lord's barn. In addition to that, he must plough 3 acres as compulsory service on demand and 2 acres pasturage ploughing. If he needs more grass, then he may earn it in such way as one allows him to. His plough rent is to plough 3 acres and to sow it with seed from his own barn. And he pays his halfpenny. As one of a pair, he must feed a hunting dog, and each peasant pays 6 loaves to the Lord's swineherd when he drives his drove of pigs to woodland pasture. Well, again, I doubt you've retained any of that. Very detailed. It's on the website, by the way. But my first thought is that it's all incredibly complicated to keep hold of. Let me note a few more helpful things, though. While not a slave, they have legal status and rights. Families of ubor status are not free. When they die, all the stuff they get given and the house will become the Lord's property again to redistribute. The dues ubors must do in return for his yard land are very heavy. They are certainly not going to be putting anything aside for that summer holiday to Bridlington he'd always wanted to take with the missus. It's between 2 and 3 days a week work for the boss when you tot it all up, possibly more. Nonetheless, they are not like the slave or the bawdar with insufficient land to feed themselves and their family. They are a self-sufficient peasant family. And not only that, they are expected to produce a surplus in many years because, as we saw, they also pay a cash rent. You may well notice in all of that, though, that I have not mentioned any public fines like the church scot or tax. They are scot-free. They do pay the halfpenny. That, though, is a payment which each household pays towards alms for the poor, which is a precursor to a charge that will be called Peter's pence. However, what they do not pay is geld, public tax, to the king. You might think that's a good thing, but you would be wrong to so think. I can almost hear you gasp with frank disbelief, the hollowness of your laugh. But to pay geld was a sign that you are a fully paid-up card-carrying member of the tribe and community. You have status. I know that sounds all wrong, but next time you look at your pay calculation and see all that money heading towards the government, feel not the pain and discomfort, but the thrill and pride of the old English small farmer travelling to the Hundred Court to take his part in the tithing, to pay his geld as a free man should. It meant you were part of the moral economy, a person of honour. In fact, landlords were very keen to prevent their bawdars and yabors from claiming that they paid the geld, because if they did, it was a sign that they were not a serf, they were a free man. There are court cases of disputes between villagers and lords that survive, and often the villagers are trying to claim that they are free and therefore have access to royal justice and shouldn't be able to have these dues imposed on them from the lord of kind of service and that sort of thing. To support their arguments in these cases, they often use paying tax as evidence. Landlords didn't want that. Oh, dearie me, no. They owned the unfree as part of their chattels, and that's the way they liked it. The entry we read earlier has another angle. As I said, the element of a free year at the start almost has the feeling of an incentive to join the estate. Now, there is a law of Ina written in the early 8th century, which goes as follows. If a man takes a yard of land or more at a fixed rent and ploughs it, and if the lord requires service as well as rent, the tenant need not take the land if the lord does not give him a dwelling. Looking that the other way round, by accepting the house, the yabor gives up an enormous amount of independence. Taking the house means that they are then unfree. They then cannot leave either lord or land. They are then at the mercy of their lord, who may choose what rent he thinks appropriate. The key differentiator, which gets referred to again and again, is that the yabor, unlike the free peasant, does not know what work he will do day to day. He must simply do what the lord decides at any particular time. The life and status of the serf, the yabor, is from the start a product of a contract with a private landowner, as distinct from the public status of a free person, of a churl. They are to some degree private property. The yabor may not be a slave, but nor is he free, and I cannot help but think of Dungeons and Dragons, sorry. The level 3 skeleton may not be alive, but nor is he dead. He is the undead. Okay. Such, then, are the changing lives of a group of the Anglo-Saxon peasantry. We have heard how residency, especially of ecclesiastical estates, have led to an intensification of production and an intensification of lordship. For many, those extra demands have resulted in a loss of status and freedom. It is important not to assume, as many have, that the yabor and bawdar of the inland estate are the typical Anglo-Saxon peasant or churl. This is an assumption that has been made by many and led to the idea that feudalism had arrived before the Norman conquest. Now, there are similar aspects between the yabor and the bawdar with the medieval feudal villein that will appear after 1066. Here is the arrival of an arrangement that gave land for very defined work. It is a significant change. But it is not based on the principle of property, of rights vested in land ownership of land for military service. It is a personal contract between lord and peasant. In a sense, it falls into that idea of a moral economy, though a rather one-sided one. In return for protection, food, land, work, the individual gives their service. And most importantly, of course, it's only part of the Anglo-Saxon peasantry. There is another world out there, the more traditional world of warland, the lands of the traditional free peasantry and churl. And it is to them, their lives and customs and rights, that we will turn in the next episode. Do remember the PDF slides on the website, everyone, thehistoryofengland.co.uk. Slides 17 to 20 refer to this episode. There is a homepage for the Anglo-Saxon series, thehistoryofengland.co.uk/podcast/Anglo-Saxon England, if you want to see what's going on. Also, don't forget that on that very same website, you can see how to become a member of the history of England and the sort of glories that will become yours if you do so, as well as the pride, the extra spring in your step that will be yours. Until next time then, thank you for listening, everyone. Do let me know what you think. Come along to the website or Facebook site, that sort of thing, have a chat. Most importantly, though, good luck and have a great week.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.